So I'm going to discuss Kierkegaard in a bit more detail, having given you that introduction, mainly because I think it's complementary to what I've been saying, and it introduces perhaps a somewhat fuller perspective on a couple of the issues his own work does. So Kierkegaard acknowledges the same three dimensions to the human person that I have talked about. He speaks of them in these terms: the bodily. This is the way he's been translated into English. The soulish. Horrible word, but that's the one that's being used in the translations up to this point. And the spirit. By soulish, he means very much the same thing as what I mean by psychic. The sensitive stream of consciousness. Sensitive stream of consciousness. Associations and feelings and emotions and strivings and sensations and memories and images and so on and so forth. It's very much the same thing as what I mean by psychic. By spirit, he does not mean, at least explicitly, that whole creative vector. He hasn't got that one worked out to the same degree of differentiation that Lonergan does. But he means primarily freedom. Or what, in Lonergan's schema, is the fourth level of the creative vector. Freedom of self-determination. Those moments of decision, which I determine what I am going to do, who I am going to be. For those of you who have read Becker's treatment of Kierkegaard in Chapter 5 of The Denial of Death, Becker misinterprets Kierkegaard at this point. The soulish and the spiritual are distinct for Kierkegaard. Becker tends to read Kierkegaard as though they were one and the same. So he gets Kierkegaard into the same dualism, consciousness and body, that he himself is caught in. And that's not Kierkegaard's treatment of the human person. The fifth chapter of The Denial of Death, in some ways, is the finest chapter in the book, but on this particular point, it's a misinterpretation of Kierkegaard's writings. It tends to identify soulish and spirit. It's not my reading, and it's not some of the other critics' readings of Kierkegaard. James Collins, for instance, doesn't read him that way. So, we have in the human person those three dimensions. Now, in the animal, the lower animal, lower than we are, or other than we are, lower than we are, I think would be a safe statement. The animal is, says Kierkegaard, a naturally determined synthesis, a synthesis determined by nature of the bodily and the soulish, or the bodily and the psychic. The synthesis, now we're talking about the animal, the synthesis of the body and the psychic is determined by nature. The relationship of the psyche to the body in the animal is determined by nature. The psyche and the body work together in a spontaneous, thoughtless, unreflective, instinctual manner. The psyche and the body work together in a spontaneous, thoughtless, unreflective, instinctual manner. The animal's condition, he says, is a condition both of ignorance and of innocence. We may blame a dog for making a mess, but we really don't mean moral guilt when we do that. We're really not talking. The dog is innocent. Ignorance and innocence. The psyche and the body work together in a state of primordial bliss. Ignorance, bliss. Ignorance is innocence in that sense. The human problem for Kierkegaard is that the synthesis of the psyche and the body is not so easy for the human person. The synthesis is not determined by nature. The psyche is somewhat free from the body. It's rooted in the body, but it's much more flexible. Than it is. It's much more flexible vis-a-vis the bodily determinations than is the psyche of the animal. So, for instance, the bodily movements of a human being can be trained to such an extent that a human being can become a concert pianist through bodily movements. There's a certain flexibility there of a conscious, sensitive psyche from the underlying mind determinants. The statistical probability of a monkey sitting at a piano and playing Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto is minimal. But a human being's sensitivity can be adjusted through training and discipline because it is flexible vis-a-vis its bodily base. Up to a certain point. Flexibility only goes so far, but it is great. So there's a free space in our sensitivity vis-a-vis the body, which means that the direction in the movement of life, to use my terminology, is not easy to find. It's not posited by nature. Same way that it is in the animal. The synthesis of the psyche and the body. What relationship my psyche will have to my body is a function of the decisions that I make as to who I am going to be. This is the way Kierkegaard comes at the problem of the human synthesis. What the relationship of my psyche, sensitive psyche, to my body is, will be a function of the decisions in which I decide who I am, what I am going to do. So what relationship the psyche will have to the body in my hands, not determined just by natural instinct. The psyche has a bodily base, but there's a flexibility vis-a-vis that bodily base that is not found in the other animals. Okay? In our decisions, we can tie the body too close, or the psyche too closely to the body. And that's what he means by the aesthetic sphere of existence. He's not using aesthetic here as artistic. He's using it, the word, in a different sense. The aesthetic sphere of existence, or the person who lives in the aesthetic sphere of existence, is the person who has tied the psyche too closely to the body. So that the psychic experiences have too much of a bodily meaning. Too exclusive a bodily meaning. For all my feelings, images, memories, associations, and so on. Too exclusively bodily meaning attached to those. But in my decisions, I can also divorce the psyche too sharply from the body. So that you get what Becker, quoting Kierkegaard, calls the person with too much possibility. That is to say, the person whose meaning structure of meaning, is not bounded by the limitation of the body. It's exactly what I'm talking about in terms of the displacement and the direction of the contributes that heads in the limit to schizophrenic psychosis. Start spinning around in a world that is your own creation. A person with too much possibility. So, says Kierkegaard, in order to avoid either of these displacements, we have to be very carefully attentive to our interior psychic states. We need to keep a guard over our heart. We need to attend to the self that we are becoming. In either or, he discusses two possibilities in his book, Either Or. And these two possibilities are characters. He's not talking about them in the abstract. Don Juan, the mythical character, prelude to the Playboy philosophy of our own time. Don Juan, and a character that Kierkegaard makes up by the name of Judge Williams. When Kierkegaard was a child, his father used to take him on imaginary excursions. Sometimes it was just in the living room of their house. They would imagine that they were in some kind of faraway place. And they would imagine who they met and what was going on. Their interior being. And this is at least one of the sources of the absolutely extraordinary delicacy in which Kierkegaard is capable of discussing interior states. Extraordinary sensitivity to the nuances of human interior. And you find it in his discussion of Don Juan and Judge Williams in Either Or. This extremely subtle, nuanced, highly refined articulation of interior movements. So one of the most brilliant things I've ever read in terms of that kind of thing. Don Juan is a person who has freely posited a relationship between the psyche and the body that ties the psyche too closely to the body. Don Juan he's using him as an instance of that kind of thing. All of his psychic experiences have a purely bodily meaning. Don't have the meaning of genuine human sexuality. They have the meaning of a perverted human sexuality that is purely and simply pleasure-oriented. And the whole of all of his psychic experiences, as Kierkegaard describes, you see, are the psyche is tied too closely to the body. Don Juan lives in the aesthetic sphere of existence. He is an example of a person who lives in the aesthetic sphere of existence. Judge William, a character that Kierkegaard has made up, is a person who lives in the ethical sphere of existence. Judge William has freely set a course in life through his own decisions, whose result is that his psyche is related to his body, but also related to other meanings. So he's not off the deep end on the other side. Huh? Judge William is not to a point, at least, tending in the direction of a displacement towards transcendence. He has kept his roots in the body, but his psyche does not have only bodily meanings. His feelings, you see, also go in the direction of a devotion to civic responsibility. He's genuinely devoted in his feelings to that. He's, as you can see, judge. Huh? He's a person who has taken seriously civic responsibility and his feelings are responsible. They are feelings of responsibility for the civic order. fidelity to wife and family. He has an affective orientation in that direction as a result of the decisions that he has made. At times difficult decisions, but he has developed affective habits that lead his psyche away from purely bodily meanings. A life of fairness and civic virtue. Discriminating selection of responsibilities and tasks. There are some things that I can do and am responsible for doing, and there are other things that, however good they may be, I can't do them. I'm not responsible for them. He has that sense of what he is and is not able and responsible to do. So those would be some of the indications of the way in which his psyche and the psyche of the person who lives in the ethical sphere of existence, where the feelings tend towards other ends besides purely bodily ends, but yet without being divorced from the bodily base. He's not living a schizophrenic existence at all. Judge would not intend in that direction, except I get to one point, which we'll get to in a few moments. All right, now, the title of the book is Either Or. One must choose between the aesthetic and the ethical as the sphere in which one will live one's life. One has to choose between those. These two alternative ways of being human. One must, by free decision, choose, in Kierkegaard's terms, what relationship one's affective psyche will have to one's body. It is an inevitable choice for any person who has the use of reason. And Kierkegaard makes it obvious from the way he discusses these two people that the one whose choice he respects is Judge William. He does not respect the freeze positing of himself that Don Juan has done. He respects Judge Williams' choice. And in our language, the choice of the aesthetic as the sphere of existence in which one will live is a choice for displacement of the balance in the direction of limitation. Don Juan has displaced the balance in the direction of limitation. He has caught him too exclusively in bodily limits. Now, when one is confronted with that choice, when one realizes that the relationship of one's psyche to one's body is a function of one's own decisions, one experiences existential dread. When one realizes that the relationship of one's psyche to one's body is a function of one's own decisions, experiencing existential dread. It's in my hands what I am going to, what my experience, my sensitive experience is going to be, is my doing. It's in my hands. I posit the synthesis of psyche and body, to use Kierkegaard's language. It's not given by nature and by stimulus response and so on. Certainly not exclusively given by that. It is a function of the decisions that I make. And once I realize how important my freedom is in making my experience what it's going to be, I experience dread. This is a theme that has been picked up by the existentialists in the 20th century, the dread of freedom. To the point where Jean-Paul Sartre says we are condemned to be free. One thing over which we are not free is to be free. I'm not free not to be free. So, once I know that I make the relationship between psyche and body, the ignorance of the animal is finished. I no longer live in the ignorant state of the animal. And the first innocence of conscious life is over. I am expelled from paradise. And he takes the whole story of Adam and Eve as a way of talking about this awareness. And how we all go through the expulsion from paradise when we realize that our experience is in our own hands. The end of innocence and the end of ignorance. Dread is a psychic experience. It's a dread on the part of a psyche whose fate lies in the hands of the human spirit. Lower animals do not experience what Kierkegaard calls dread. They experience fear, anxiety, and so on and so forth. But what he's talking about when he's talking about dread, talking about the particular affective realization on the part of a psyche whose fate as psyche lies in the hands of one's own freedom. It's in my hands what my experience is going to be like. Now, while between John 1 and Judge William, you see, he says, the only decision I respect is that of Judge William. That choice of the ethical does not alleviate dread. Dread remains. It alleviates, in a sense, one source of dread, but opens one upon another. There are two primordial moments of dread in human existence, and they can recur in one's life. It's not like, well, I've gone through the first dread and I got the second one. No, you can go back. Judge William has chosen the law. Has chosen to live a lawful existence. But Kierkegaard is planted firmly in the tradition that extends from Paul through Augustine to Luther, to know that the law is good, but that it increases sin and guilt. That is Pauline to the core. Once ignorance and innocence are finished, sin and guilt take over. So, the choice of the ethical introduces a new dimension of dread, the dread that is connected with the awareness, the knowledge of sin and guilt. And I have to be freed from the law if I am going to be freed from dread. Pauline freedom from the law is necessary. I'm going to be relieved of primordial existential dread. And he shows this in Judge William as he nears the end of his discussion of Judge William. Judge William is just a little bit too intent on self-justification. Just a little bit too intent. He's a fine, upright man. But in his solitary moments, he questions. His attempts to be in the law and under the law are themselves something of a deception or a lie. He's solidly inserted into a cultural framework. But what if that fabric itself is inauthentic? Judge William experiences dread too. He has made a choice for the ethical. It's a choice he had to make if he was going to be authentic. But now, in a certain way, he has to give up that choice. Not by way of falling back into the aesthetic, but by way of relinquishing that choice as the source of his own existence. He has to relinquish the choice that he made for the good, not to fall back into the less than good or the other than good, but to keep that choice from being perverted into evil. That choice for the good is perverted into evil when it is made the source of one's own being, the source of one's own virtue, the source of one's own lawfulness. And in my language, if at this point one doesn't let go of the law, sense in which Paul is talking about freedom from the law, not in the sense of falling back into moral irresponsibility, in the sense of giving up the law as the source of your own being. If at that point you don't let go of the law, you displace the balance in the direction of transcendence. Not in the direction of limitation, but in the direction of transcendence. You are making yourself into more than what you are. You are not the cause of your own being. You are insisting on being your own creator, the causa sui, the cause of your suffering. And you're lying when you do that, because you are denying the creaturely status of your own being. And that's the second primordial moment of dread. Having made a choice for the good, I have to relinquish the tendency by which I would make that choice the source of my own being. Got to give that up. That is not moral renunciation, but it is, in Kierkegaard's language, leaping into a qualitatively different sphere of existence, which he calls the religious. And that's the meaning of the leap of faith. It's not a leap into doctrine. Leap into a mode of being in which I let the source of my own existence be other than myself.